Hey, everybody. Welcome to another Poison Pen book interview. My name's Patrick. I am our science fiction and fantasy selector here at the Pen. Today, I am really honored to have Cadwell Turnbull for his newest book, No Gods, No Monsters, which is by far one of my favorite books of the year. I'm really excited to talk to Cadwell about this book. I hope this gets you excited to read it as well. Cadwell, welcome to the Poison Pen podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to be here. Oh, you're so welcome. Absolutely. So this is really a cool book. This is your sophomore book. Your first book was called The Lesson. You're also a master of short fiction, and you also teach writing
North Carolina State University.
North Carolina State, yeah. Okay.
In Raleigh, yeah.
Perfect. So this is your sophomore book, and I've got to say that it is excellent. We often talk about, you know, the second book being a little bit more difficult. I think that this was a really awesome read, and it's sort of blowing up. It's taking the internet and bookstores by storm. You've gotten some really glowing reviews. Can you tell us a little bit about the invention of No Gods, No Monsters?
Okay. It's been, you know, this is still now it's October 1st, but it's less than a month since the book has been out. So it's been kind of wild to see the response it's been getting. So when I was working on The Lesson, and it was in that in-between space where it was in ARC form and people were looking at it, but it wasn't out yet, I pitched this book, and I was hoping at the time that I would be able to do a trilogy. And I pitched the first book, and then I pitched some details for the second and third book in the trilogy. And it basically came out of, you know, listening to and reading urban fantasy books with my wife and really liking the genre. And I grew up like really being into Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel and Charmed and, a huge fan of the Underworld series. And so it seemed really strange to me that I hadn't written more in the genre. And I thought, you know, this would be a really cool genre to play in since I love it so much. I love all of these monsters. And so I pitched it to Blackstone, you know, in hopes that they would dig it, and they did. And then, you know, as I was working on it, all kinds of weird stuff showed up to the party. You know, it became a little bit horror, it became very political, it also became very metaphysical and philosophical. And the original conception was, how would society respond if monsters came out of the shadows? Mm-hmm. And that was the germ of the idea. And then all of this other stuff, you know, why would they be in the shadows? What would force them out of the shadows? And, you know, how would different people that orient differently respond to either seeing the existence of monsters or being a monster themselves? And all of that stuff kind of, you know, stewed together and became the book.
It's really an interesting take. I've got to say that I was unnerved reading throughout a good portion of the book. I felt like you've got this really eerie tone throughout the entire I would almost call each section of the book almost like an episode. You mm-hmm, take us mm-hmm. into the mind and space of a particular character that's important within the entire story, and you're building the story from these pieces as they've gone along. I don't know, you really kept me, what would be the best way? Not feeling like I had a good sure foot in this world. Was that part of your intent when you were putting this together?
It is a huge theme of the book and the series, how people respond to the unknown, hitting up against things that they don't understand, and what that means for them, how that affects them psychologically, but also how institutions of power use mystery or secrets to manipulate people. And so it shows up in this book quite a lot, and it's going to show up in the future books as well. yeah, it was one of those things that, you know, when I started thinking about, well, what would be the circumstances that would create this sort of thing where monsters would be unknown and then suddenly known, it seemed to me that there would be like a really vast underground, you know, like the there would be a world beneath the world that we know that would allow this to happen. And so exploring that and using that in a bunch of different interesting ways was, you know, a big part of the project. Also, you mentioned that it feels like episodes, and one of the ways that I conceptualized it structurally was like a TV show, you know, so that it's, you know, episodes of a TV show that build off each other. Each episode is focused on a particular character, and then they kind of like pass the baton to each other, you know, till eventually they converge at the end.
Right.
Yeah.
And without giving too much away, because this book is really part of the fun of it is the mystery of what's going on and what's occurring. But essentially the premise of the story is our, not really our main character, but the main focus is the murder of Lincoln, African-American who's been shot by police. Mysteriously, he is completely naked in the middle of the road. And whether or not this is a crime of police brutality, whether this was a crime associated with something he was actually doing, what was going on, and then really the quest of his sister, Lena, to figure out what it is, what caused his death, how did he die, why did he die in the way that he did. And it's an interesting mystery as well. And one of the things I truly love about urban fantasy is that it is, at its heart, a mystery novel.
Yeah, it's, you know, when I was thinking about this, you know, immediate revelation, what form it would take, it seemed to me that, you know, I was drawing a lot from, you know, 2015, 2016, when I was working on my MFA, there was like a string of police brutality videos that came out, and I got really caught up in it. You know, I would go online and talk to people and try to get them to understand that this was a serious problem. And it feels like this happens, maybe it's not every decade, but every 4 or 5 years in waves where there will just be a lot of these incidents. And when I was thinking about, well, how would monsters come out? This seemed like a really, you know, interesting place to go for all of the ways that it would be unpacked throughout the book. You know, Lincoln is a Black man. He's also a man that is struggling with addiction. He's also queer. And so it seemed to me like in some ways, it would be a way to talk about how we frame people and how those framings become complicated over time. Like Lincoln's story grows and grows through the people that he interacts with and through their memories of him. And it was also a way for me to kind of like take this video, which is like a really important linchpin of the story, and kind of like expand the camera further and further in seeing all the ways that this one moment affected all of these different lives.
Exactly. And one of the things that I really appreciated about the book is that you went into this novel is incredibly complex, and it's hard not, I don't want to spoil anything for our readers here. So I'll kind of talk in vagaries, but really the complexity within the book, you're also talking about the complexity of this incredibly important social issue, which is, you know, this continued systemic racism that we have currently, you know, underneath, running underneath throughout the entire United States. So I find it really interesting and really an eye-opening way of looking at that issue.
Right, it's sort of, you know, I really like werewolves. You know, I'm a huge fan of, you know, this particular monster, Shifters in particular, but werewolves specifically. And it felt like a really interesting way to, like, you know, write a story about things that we recognize and we love, and but also put a spin on it and use it to talk about some other things as well. And it you know, in a lot of ways, the book is about looking at institutions of power that have really long lives that operate mostly, you know, outside of our eyes and without accountability, and trying to see how those institutions of power play into the everyday experiences of, you know, these people, these characters in the story.
One of my favorite aspects behind this novel is you really get into secret societies as you're talking about these old systemic institutions. I'm curious, what sort of research did you do on secret societies? Especially on the East Coast, I think that we think it's probably maybe a little bit more pronounced than here in the West, in the Southwest of the United States. We don't really see it, but it's the secret societies are pretty heavy on the East Coast, and especially Ivy League schools, places like that. What sort of research did you have to do to kind of prepare yourself to get into that mindset?
Well, I'll say, I don't want to sound like I have a tinfoil hat on. Well, I'll say, right, on the East Coast, there's a lot of secret societies that we recognize. They're famous, you know, or infamous secret societies. But I was home recently in the Virgin Islands, and I was having a conversation with a taxi driver, and he was talking about a secret society on St. Croix, you know, like, and, you know, he called it by name. He talked about it, like, you know, the whole history of the secret society. And so, you know, one of the characters in the book has this suspicion that, you know, they're quite common. And I think that might be true. I think that there's, and the way that I think about it is, secret societies form out of paranoia that other secret societies exist. And it's really this kind of like elaborate game of, you know, escalating paranoia that is building and building and building over time. I did do some research. I looked into, you know, and this was, some of this was before I even knew what the book would be. You know, I read a lot about the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which shows up in the book. I read about the Telema religion. I hope I'm getting that right. I read about Scientology, and, you know, and there's a character in the book that kind of traces connections between these three organizations over time. And those organizations do have those like connections. It's strange. It's kind of like, I don't know, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. It's a game you could play with secret societies. But really what I was interested in is like using that concept, because there's secret societies as they exist in the real world, which are kind of, I would say, mostly benign. I don't know. I can't say for sure. And then there's the trope of secret societies that, you know, exist through media, which is much more nefarious. Who knows? That might be closer to real life than we know. But playing those things against each other and seeing what would happen, you know, it was just really fun. And I read a number of academic papers from a particular academic. I think his name is Max Martin. Is that right? I'm not sure. But he wrote about both secret societies and cooperatives, and I'm really interested in cooperatives. And he kind of, it was interesting to see a scholar talk about both of these things, like opaque structures of power and then really transparent structures of power in relationship. And so I have a character in a book that kind of makes comparisons between cooperatives and secret societies as kind of like flip sides of the same coin.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unnerving to think that there are groups out there that exist. I mean, we think about things like, you know, colleges and universities have fraternities, and in a way they're a brotherhood or secret society, but you know, this is going deeper and further, and you know, whether or not they have connections of power, certainly in this there's also worship of monsters. Right. Which is really, really interesting and always a good sort of foil within the book. When you're talking about some of these really interesting secret societies, I always think of Aleister Crowley, a very strange English occultist And I think, gosh, I've got to say, I love Ghost Adventures. And they did a tour one time of one of his supposed caverns that he did. And I always enjoy watching those shows and getting a little spooked out.
He shows up a lot. He shows up a lot in, I'm working on the second book right now, and he's a figure in it. And he's connected to the Golden, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. He's connected to, weirdly, Scientology. And then he's connected to this, Telemite religion. And so it's, he's this kind of figure that kind of, crosses all of these different societies. And there's a character that's a perspective character in the second book, Margie Cameron, who is referred to in the first book. She's this actress, also artist, also secret society person. And she has some interesting connections to Aleister Crowley as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's really an interesting and sort of interesting individual. I mean, even mm-hmm. just reading an article on him from Wikipedia will kind of give you an idea of what to expect. In terms of metaphysics makes its way throughout the book quite a bit as well. There's certainly the visions that Lena, one of your main characters, exhibits, things like that. And there's a lot of connections to your home in the Virgin Islands. What made you decide to kind of take it back? Because we do think of the Virgin Islands, the Caribbean, as being very influential in terms of mysticism and beauty and a little bit of the mysterious.
This is an interesting question. Okay, so I'm gonna answer this a bit with a story. So when I was a kid, I would, you know, go visit my grandmother all the time, and she lived in this area of St. Thomas called Hidden Valley. And, you know, I would, you know, when I visited her, I would go and play with the neighborhood kids after school. And we would all hang out, run around in the street and do what kids do. And eventually we would, you know, there was a place up the road that had, they would sell specials, which is this kind of like popsicle you get in a cup. It's uh-huh. It's very Caribbean, and also candies and all kinds of stuff. And so, you know, eventually we would want candy, and they would be really cheap. Like, I think the specials were like 25 cents. So we'd go up, we'd run up the hill and to get the specials, but passing the, you know, on the way, there was this house that sat on the top of the hill that was, you know, that was always like dark in the inside. No one lived there. No one parked outside of it. And I don't know what the story, I don't know how the story began, but we thought that there was a particular, you know, regional monster called Cowfoot Lady. You know, it's what you expect, a woman with cow feet. And okay. she was living in that house. And every time we would pass the house, we would run really fast so that she wouldn't catch us. And then we would get our specials, and then we would run past it and go back down. And then we would just play like nothing. It was just like a part of the day, you know what I mean? And I feel like in the Caribbean, I tell that story, and everyone has a story like that, where this kind of like fantastical thing existed next to the mundane thing. And it was one of those things that everyone took for granted as real. And even, you know, talking to adults, there's a monster in the book called a Sukuyant. This is a story I heard from my aunt. My cousins would tell me not to, you know, answer if someone whispered my name in the night, because it might be a Jumbi. And these things just kind of, it was just a part of, you know, living. And it was, we would have normal lives every other, you know, in every other instance, but then there would be these like really strange, fantastical things that would just enter into the story once in a while. And I feel like, that became a really big part of when I was thinking about Nogaz the Monster, is that kind of different relationships to monsters or monstrosity, this kind of like community monster that just lives there. And you just kind of take for granted that they're there. And then this kind of like, that totally in the shadows, scary creature that you have to run from. That is, you know, a more popular conception of a monster and where those two kinds of monsters meet.
It's so interesting because, you know, we really do have regional monsters or regional mysteries, so to speak. I mean, here in the Southwest, we have the Chupacabra, the Skinwalker, right, yeah. And also La Llorona, the crying woman, the woman who lost her child. And if you hear her spirit crying by the stream, don't go near it because she'll drown you. I mean, there's, you know, the Southwest really is filled with also with some of these mysteries and these monsters and these regional regional beliefs. And it's just fascinating because, you know, fiction does such a good job of bringing these kind of myths and legends to life. And that's one of the things I really loved about No Gods, No Monsters is you really brought these characters to life. You really brought them also with a strong level of complexity. It isn't, this book isn't your slasher horror. This book is much more your, you know, this undercurrent of unease, which I really like. And every now and again, you'll have these moments of just strong horror, but also you've really made sort of a brilliant political comment. And so I'm curious in that regards, why do you think it is that horror, and I'm thinking like science fiction, fantasy, and horror today is really touching on these incredibly important social issues and explaining them so well. And so I'm really curious, why do you think that is?
It's a really good question. I think that horror does a really good job, strangely, of representing the kinds of anxieties that marginalized people experience on the regular, right? It's why it lends so well to, you know, having like a political reading. There was just a recent, you know, remake of Candyman and, but so, I remember, yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I saw it with a bunch of friends and it was a great social commentary.
Mm-hmm. I have not watched the remake, but I remember watching the original when I was a kid and it has scared me ever since. And I've been afraid to rewatch that movie, you know, because it's something about it was so visceral. And I just think that there's this kind of like, I don't know, like we were talking about police brutality earlier. There's this way, you know, a really good example of this in film is Fruitvale Station. It's, you know, it was, oh man, I'm spacing on his name. He was the director for Black Panther and the first Creed movie. And this was his first movie. It was an indie movie. And it starred Michael B. Jordan, who returns in Black Panther. And it's about a case of police brutality. But there's the way that it tells the story is it takes you through the day of this person before he dies. It's a spoiler, I guess. And it's also based on true events. And you see him in all of these different facets of his life. You see him doing mundane things, like, you know, spending time with his daughter, you know, talking to his mother. And, you know, it comes to this like fated moment where he dies. And it's horror in real life. You know what I mean? It's this kind of thing that shows up. It has these drastic, you know, tragic effects, and then it goes away. You know, it's sometimes when you see these things happen, it feels to me at least like an act of nature, or like a monster like rising up from the depths. And I feel like I think that specific experience lends really well to horror. You know, it's like taking that thing that feels very monstrous that just shows up in people's lives and turning it into a monster. Mm-hmm.
I also think our readership tends to be more diverse and hopefully more willing to accept diversity within their fiction, which I think is really something to be said. You know, there's been some really great books. N.K. Jemisin's The City We Became, I thought was particularly brilliant last year. Tasman Muir also wrote
Gideon
the Ninth, which I really liked, which was...
And Harrow and... Is it Harrow the Ninth as well?
Harrow the Ninth and Gideon the Ninth, yeah.
Yes, right.
Lesbian Necromancers in Space. I mean...
So dope.
It's real. They're really cool books.
And I still haven't read Harrow, but she's an incredible writer.
Gideon is a cool book. I think that was one of my favorite. And it was a surprise, you know. We do a Sci Friday book club. And so we try to pick books that were nominated during the current year for the Hugo and the Nebula, at least a couple of them each year. And so we read Gideon the Ninth, and I was really impressed with that. I think that it's becoming such a neat way of bringing in diversity and discussing, and this is the wrong word that I'm going to use, and I apologize in advance, but normalizing the minority. And I think that that's really important, because I think that we're all humans, we all are trying to grow, we're trying to be better. And I think that it's a cool way of bringing in diversity into our lives. And I think that that's part of what's really cool about horror and science fiction right now, is they're doing, I think, a really good job of it.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I keep getting really excited about where the genre is going, because, being a genre nerd, like, I grew up watching all of these, these things that everyone recognized. You know, I was a huge fan of Stargate, specifically SG-1. I watched I would watch it on repeat. You know, I was a huge anime nerd. I watched a ton of anime. I watched, I mentioned Buffy and I mentioned Charmed. And there's this what's happening is that all of these young nerds that were from all of these diverse backgrounds, who are watching a lot of these same things and, you know, loving it, but wanting to see more of themselves represented in it, are now in the position where they get to tell stories where they center themselves. And also they get to look at these tropes, you know, like first contact, aliens showing up, and getting to talk about it through the lens of being from a place that was, that has a history of colonization. That's what I did with the lesson. But, you know, you also get to talk about, take the space opera, you know, and gothic horror and remix it and create something like Gideon the Ninth, you know, and it's just so exciting to see that, you know, these tropes like reimagined through all of these new, it's not that it's new, it's more lens, you know, that we're not getting just a particular flavor of that trope, we're getting so many different flavors of the trope.
Exactly. And I think that that's one of the coolest things about this genre, and seeing it evolve and change and becoming more than what it originally was. Right. You know, you go back and you read Lovecraft, and of course he was insanely racist, and but it's good to go back and see where we came from and where he started with horror, and, you know, how can we improve? What's it going to ask you? So we were talking earlier before the program, I think you're really in love with werewolves, and I'm just really curious where that love of the shapeshifter came from.
I think, you know what, this is a question I don't know the answer to. So I think there has always been a fascination with people or creatures that can change form. I think that that's just something that I think is really cool, because honestly, I wish I could. there's a character in the book that I don't want to, you know, spoil anything, but, you know, he's a shifter, but he shifts into something that, you know, I just find really exciting, you know, and, you know, it just came to me and it was like, well, let me try it, see how that works. And it was, you know, he turned out to be one of my favorite characters, you know, and.
Is he going to make an appearance in future stories, you think?
He has to, because, you know, I love him so much now. And I've been, you know, I have a ton of favorite characters in the book, and there's things I know about all of the characters that people don't know yet that makes me excited about them. But he's a favorite. And he regularly, you know, when people ask me which one of my characters is my favorite, I'll just say his name. His name is Dragon. This tells you a lot. And I'll just get really excited when people say that Dragon is their favorite character, because he is also my favorite, and I want nothing but good things for him. And you know, he has his own narrative arc through the three books that I'm working on within this universe. But yeah, I think it's a fascination. I think I also, you know, watched a lot of really good werewolf movies at an impressionable age, or not, maybe not good. Maybe they were bad, but I loved them anyway. So like American Werewolf in Paris is a movie that I remember from being a kid that I just loved. There's a Jack Nicholson movie called Wolf that I just absolutely love.
Oh, that's a good movie.
It is. It really is. It's Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer. It's incredible. I think I watched it, you know, maybe a few years ago. I think it, you know, no movie ages perfectly, but I think it ages really well. And then, you know, Underworld was one of those movies that just ignited this kind of fascination with me as a kid. This idea that there's this like ancient battle between vampires and werewolves. That's just fun. And, you know, I think it, you know, it definitely influenced the book in some way. It had to. It's just like, you know, watching really good media or media that I loved. And then also just being really fascinated with this idea of being able to shift forms. And I'm sure there's something deeper there that I'll think about after we talk.
Absolutely. You know, one of the cool things, though, about your book, No Gods, No Monsters, is that you're pulling from kind of our classic monsters, things that go bump in the night, secret societies, but you're really making it your own. And I think that that's incredibly difficult to do. How did you ensure that, you know, the story that you were telling maintained a level of authenticity rather than kind of copying what everybody else has done?
It was a happy accident, I think. So the werewolves are, you know, we recognize werewolves from pop culture. And, you know, even something like a dragon shifter isn't something that takes too long to find an example of. There are dragon, you know, shifters in media. But I think that what made it interesting to me, or how I found my way into it in a way that was different than, you know, other things that I, you know, quite enjoy, was, you know, I've sort of, you know, and it's one of those weird things that feels like as it was happening, I had no idea how useful it would be. It just kind of became useful over time. I was developing a cosmology in my head since I was in, you know, in undergrad. You know, just building these, you know, I had like pages and pages of like lineages of gods and, you know, all kinds of cosmic beings. And, you know, I just was fascinated with the idea of divinity, but also like divinity that kind of, you know, I might be spoiling. Well, divinity that's questioning itself and has, you know, interesting relationships to their own existence. And, you know, that plays out over their relationships with each other. And so I built this weird thing. I would try to write it in fiction and it would just not work. It was just too much like heady philosophical concept stuff. It just, there was no way to anchor it really well. And then I started writing No Gods, No Monsters, and all of these cosmic beings that have lived in my head for a really long time showed up. You know, there's a character in the book called Asha. She's been in my head for at least 15 years. There's an entity in the book called the Suvox that has been around for a really long time as well. And so like there's what I found was like I had all of these monsters that people would recognize, and then there was all of these other monsters or creatures or beings that no one would recognize because they've been kind of just kicking around in here, and I had no idea how they would work. And then they just started working with all of this other stuff that I was working on.
That is really cool. So it sounds like this was the book that you needed to write.
I think so.
I love it when that happens, because it feels good when it comes out onto the page. And for the reader, it reads incredibly smoothly. One of the things that I really love about your writing is I had to stop and reread a few passages because they were so absolutely beautiful. You did just such a great job that I had to stop, go back, and reread what you wrote just so I could fully digest and appreciate your sense of style of writing.
I appreciate that.
In terms of, I mean, people often refer to that maybe as purple prose, but you're also an established short fiction writer. And I noticed that you used a lot of what you learned from your short fiction to put together your novel. So did you feel like you kind of had the best of both worlds for this book?
I think so. And I mean, your mention of purple prose, you know, fills me with horror. I hope, you know, one of the things that I think about is, some of my favorite writers are Alice Munro and Ted Chiang, who are both spare, you know, in their treatment of storytelling, of building character, of dialogue, and all of those things. And so I try my very best to control. So, you know, I do really love lyricism, but I try to be counteract that with being pretty spare in the telling of the story and not trying to do too much. But there's a lot of, subtext and ambiguity and thematic stuff I like playing with in fiction, and I enjoy that a lot. And a lot of that came out of short stories. It's one of those things where, you know, when I was younger, I thought I was going to be a novelist, and I wrote a novel when I was in undergrad. I did not finish it. It was, I would say 60% done, but it was 60,000 words. It was the most that I had written up until that point. And then I was struggling to finish the book. And so I thought, let me try short fiction. And so I kind of pivoted into that direction and started writing short stories. And I learned so much about characterization, about dialogue, about building theme over a story, about burying, really important thematic aspects of a story in how people interact with a scene, how people interact with other people, how people interact with objects. I learned a lot about layering. So like, because short stories are short, you know, I had a lot of practice with layering meaning over each other in a scene. So that, you know, I'll have scenes, you know, and I get really excited when I can have like three or four layers of things happening in a scene at once. And so it became like a challenge to me. It's like, well, this is the thing that they're talking about. This is the thing that they're actually talking about. This is the thing that's happening under that they're not consciously aware of. This is like, you know, the subconscious or the subtext. And then this is the thematic implication that all is stewing in. And that is a thing I come back to time and time again. I did it in a lesson. You know, one of my favorite scenes in the lesson is, I feel weird talking about favorite scenes of my own work, but there's a scene where two characters are at the vet and they're talking about going away on vacation. But there's all of this stuff going on underneath. And underneath that, they're sadly, I should warn people, they're putting a cat down. I used to work at the Humane Society when I was in high school. And so I was borrowing a bit from that. And so sometimes you get really sick, you know, animals that come into the shelter, and you have to, put them down. And so they're doing that, and this is a part of their work. And that is happening, and that has some thematic significance. And then they're also having this conversation about vacation, and there's something going on between them that's really interesting and is playing out through that conversation about vacation. And so doing that kind of stuff gets me really excited, and it has informed the way I structure books. My books tend to be very episodic or mosaic-like. You know, an example I would give is Emily St. John Mandel, who I was very happy when I found her work. And I was having an existential crisis about the way I write books because there's so many POVs, and I get interested in people, and then I spend time with them. And I was like, you know, maybe I'm doing too much. And then I read Emily St. John Mandel, and I think she does it better than me, but I felt seen while reading her work. She has like the same kind of aesthetic interest or structural interest in her work.
I'm a big St. John Mandel fan myself. Station 11 still has to be one of my all-time favorite books.
Phenomenal.
It's a phenomenal book. And it's probably why I appreciate your writing as well, because I think there is that level of complexity, and there's that level of, as you said, layering. I really fell in love with the conversation at the very beginning of the book that Lena has with her partner. And I'm like, she's doing this, but she's really meaning this. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that was really brilliant in terms of how you put that together. I actually stopped and reread that scene because I really enjoyed it. And you are spare. So when you write and you describe something that's, you know, like I said, you just sort of hit that button for me where I'm like, oh, that's really, really good writing. I just read Julia Heberlin's We Are All the Same in the Dark. Mm-hmm. And that was a really interesting mystery novel because it was written in three POVs. And so we had one character for the first third of the book, and then another character, second, third. And I've got to say, I think that's a soft spot, because I've got to say that's probably my favorite mystery novel that I've read mm-hmm. this year. Who are your most influential authors? Who do you go back to? You talked about St. John Mandel. Do you have any others that you like to refer back to or study from?
So yeah, Emily St. John Mandel is high up there. I mentioned Ted Chiang, he's primarily a short story writer. And part of the thing that I love about him is he's meticulous. He spends a lot of time on a short story, and you mm-hmm. can see it when you read it. It's very smooth. Sometimes it gets very heady. I really like stories that are, I think this is one of those things that's salt to taste for some readers, but I like stories that deal heavily with ideas on the page, that they're talking about the ideas on the page, you know, and that they're exploring it. And that, you know, and I get really this satisfying feeling when someone is writing, you know, is telling a story, fiction, and they're wrestling with an idea, and you can see it on the page, but it's worded in the absolutely, you know, perfect way. Mm-hmm. And I think Ted Chiang does this. I get that same satisfied feeling when I read Ursula K. Le Guin. You know, I recently tried to explain it to my wife. I was rereading a passage to her, and I was just like, do you feel it? You know, there's just this way, she ties ideas with character. She'll start with a character, go off on an idea, and then drop back down into the character again. And there's just this really satisfied feeling I get when I read that. And so she is by far my biggest influence. Octavia Butler is also really good at that. What she's extremely good at is this kind of dark hopefulness. There's this kind of like, you know, when you read a Butler story, it can get really dark and heavy, mm-hmm. but there's this kind of like it's either a glimmer of light, or it's a complicated dark where it's like beautiful at the same time. And that's something that, you know, I reread her a lot just to try to figure out how she does that balance. And she's just also a really spare, you know, writer. And she can find a perfect image with a few sentences or a sentence. And, you know, that kind of skill is something that, like, I return to again and again. I was a huge fan of Milan Kundera. You know, I haven't read it in its original language, but The Unbearable Lightness of Being, the English translation. And the reason why I love it is because it's wrestling with a lot of big ideas as it's doing character work. And the writer or the narrator of the story will actually stop the story to talk about an idea. And I think that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Kurt Vonnegut, for the same reason, my feelings about Kundera's Unbearable Lightness of Being is more complicated now. And that shows up in the book. But I still return to that book for its experimental quality, its wrestling with ideas, and the way that it can use that to, you know, find another door into character.
That is really cool. I do have a question from the audience as well, and they want to know, are there any profound moments in your life that led to the base idea of the book?
It's heavy. So, how can I talk about this without spoiling it? There's a central character in the book that without him, the story cannot be told. And he has a very complicated relationship with a brother, you know, similar to Lena, who also has a, you know, complicated relationship to her brother for much the same reason. And that is heavily borrowed from, you know, a complicated relationship in my own life that I've worked through over decades. It's being really close to someone, to struggling with addiction, trying to parse out who that person is independent of the thing that they've been caught up in, you know, and trying to reconcile that image against, you know, the things that they struggle with and how that manifests in their life. So there's a few scenes where Lena is talking to Lincoln, and they happen in flashback, and Lincoln in those scenes can be like really brutal. There is a justification for it in the narrative. He can be mean, you know, and hurtful. But that's only a part of his personality, and part of the story is like trying to like bring out through his interactions with other people when he was sober, another story of Lincoln, you know, who is, you know, his whole self, because he can be his whole self because he's moved past this thing that has ensnared him for so long. And so that is definitely something that I've been working through as a person.
There's a really powerful scene at the very beginning of the book, so I'm not spoiling anything, where Lena is a younger woman's going in and she sees her brother Lincoln, you know, really, really stoned. Mm-hmm. And she's trying to get him out of that situation. And he just gets up, turns to her, snorts some sort of drug, I'm assuming coke, and, you know, basically says, I'm here and I'm going to do what I'm going to do. So, and it was a really brutal scene, but it was a really complicated scene because it is the sort of scene that is incredibly believable between two siblings. You know, somebody that you could clearly tell that she loved her brother, but at the same time, he was using in order to deal with something that occurs in his past. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. It was a really incredible scene that you wrote. I thought it was really powerful. Again, just a great moment within the book. Not a great moment in terms of reality.
Right.
So one of the cool things to move away from a little bit from the heavy, and it's sort of hard to see, but each episode has a really cool printed illustration. And one of our readers
in English
was really interested in you know, did you work with the artist for the illustrations between episodes? Because he felt like it really enhanced the novel and made it interesting.
So the graphic designer is Catherine English. She designed No Gods, No Monsters. It's a breathtaking cover. Like, it's one of those things where I'm like, I think, you know, people pick up this book, you know, that might not have otherwise because that cover is so eye-catching. But I think the cover also does a lot to prepare you for the book. You know, there's a lot happening in the cover. It's all living in the same space. And, you know, it was one of those things where I talked to her. She asked me, you know, what are some images that, you know, come to mind for the cover? And she did this for the lesson as well. And I told her, like, a conch shell with tendrils coming out of it. And that is the cover of the lesson. And then I told her for this one, like, there's a character in the book who is a witch and her power is through magical tattoos, because I think that's cool. And she has all of these symbols on her body and they do different things. And so I described some of the symbols to her. And then I also described some other like items that I thought was really important, like symbolically in the book. There's a knife on the cover that is in reference to Ridley, who does wood carving. There's a cat on the cover. You know, it's a big cat, but it's in reference to one of the gods. You know, I guess that's a spoiler. But and she just brought it together. She sent me like 30 different covers, you know, and this is the kind of, you know, designer she is. She put a lot of effort into each cover. They were all fantastic and it was incredibly hard to pick one. And this was the one that just kind of like hit me the hardest. And you know, she was so good that even though I was choosing that one, I was sad to see other ones go. I had to let go in my mind of the cover, you know, in that form. And, you know, I'm not answering the question. The sections, those were entirely from her taking things from those sections and creating an image to kind of like prepare people for that section. This was her. And I think that, you know, she read the book. She was in, you know, and she brought that into her artwork. And it was one of those things where when I was flipping through the pages and I saw those images, I was like, this is perfect. How did this happen? Because those things, those particular parts, I did not direct her on. I didn't say anything about it. I didn't know it was happening. And so I was just surprised when it did.
It's sort of neat when you go, because Blackstone, I wouldn't say is a huge publisher. They're a very good publisher. And they take time and effort, and they've really taken time and effort in your book. And it's so cool to see an artist that has actually read the book cover to cover, because you don't get very many artists who actually do that. Either they don't have the time, or maybe they haven't been given it, or, you know, a myriad of different reasons. And the fact that Blackstone also gave you the opportunity to have input into your cover as well really is testament, because we hear a lot of writers who said, well, clearly the artist and the, you know, didn't read my book and it's an okay cover, but it has nothing to do with the story or the plot.
Yeah, it's a shame. Yeah.
And that's nice. The fact that they've given you that leverage. You have signed quite a few books for us, which is nice. And I think our store owner may have put in another order for more books, because
I just got them today. They expect them shortly. I came home and the guy was bringing the box to the door, and I was like, I think that's you know, some Poison Pen books that I have to sign. So
yeah. What's really nice, I mean, I think we're all really enthusiastic about it, and I'm shouting this book from the rooftops, because I think everybody should read it. It has something for everybody, and I like the fact that you get dark without getting, like you said, there's a glimmer of hope, very similar to Octavia Butler, and I was excited that you mentioned her, because she's really having a resurgence at the moment. I have a hard time keeping her books on shelf, which makes me really happy. She deserves she deserves that as well. So Caldwell, what you're talking about, a second book, really, that we're going to be doing a full trilogy. So you're signed for a full trilogy on this?
I am. It's called The Convergence Saga. And, you know, that name, we went through a bunch of names for what this series would be called. Originally, it was called No Gods, No Monsters. And the title of the first, like, so No Gods, No Monsters of book one of No Gods, No Monsters. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But we talked about, you know, giving the series a name that was distinct from the original book, and Convergence Saga, you know, was the favorite. There were some other ones that I think gave too much away, but Convergence Saga, I think, prepares people for what the story is about. It's in a lot of ways, the story is about community and community finding itself. And so over the course of the series, the community, you know, I don't want to spoil this book, but you're starting to see a community building, but they're still kind of separated. And so the books are about them finding each other. And it's also about, you know, one thing we haven't talked about yet is that there's quite a lot of like cosmic stuff happening, and it's a convergence of like cosmic events. And so, you know, We Are the Crisis is the second book. They're all kind of based on like political slogans, like radical slogans. So No Gods, No Masters, No Gods, No Masters. We Are the Crisis. And then the last book is A Ruin Great and Free. And they're all, you know, telling the story of human beings, monsters, and gods.
I don't know. I'm excited now to read all three of them. And I'm hoping that you'll be coming back to talk about books two and three as they release, because
I'd love to.
We really, really love these books. And I've got to say, you're a talented writer. And, you know, thank you so much. So for those of you who want to support The Poison Pen, our podcast, et cetera, just a quick brief commercial, you can order directly from the bookstore or go to poisonpen.com. We're more than glad to send you Cadwell's new book. So there's that, but if you don't buy from us, buy from any bookstore, because you know, we wouldn't be around, authors wouldn't be around without your support. So that, I think, is the more important thing. Cadwell, thank you so much. I mean, this has been a really full hour, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm sure it's super late where you're at, your East Coast, so it's about 10 o'clock.
Yeah, but you know, this has been great. You know, great questions. You know, I'm just so honored, you know, that you wanted to talk to me. So thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Absolutely. And everybody have a great night. We will be seeing you sometime next year. Take care, guys.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.